Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. You may have heard a recent news item on KWGS about the announcement of a new federal grant that connects the Tulsa and Oklahoma City Health Departments with navigators who will help connect Medicare and Medicaid patients in need to social services as a means of improving their overall health. Called the Route 66 Accountable Health Community Collaborative, the $4.5 million five-year grant is from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And my guest today, Dr. David Kendrick, is the principal investigator of the project. Kendrick is the chief executive officer of the MyHealth Community Access Network, a statewide health information exchange, which essentially means it's a nonprofit utility serving as a data connector for hundreds of medical practices in Oklahoma to share patient information to better serve communities and avoid wasteful and duplicative care. As we discuss often on this program, social determinants of health like food, housing, education, and employment play a bigger role in our overall health than the trillions we collectively spend as a nation in our discordant healthcare system. The Route 66 Accountable Health Community Collaborative is a first-of-its-kind grant from the Department of Health and Human Services, paying to create linkages to social service agencies rather than direct healthcare, with an eye toward reducing the overall costs of healthcare as people's fundamental needs are more directly addressed. Dr. David Kendrick of the MyHealth Access Network and the Route 66 Accountable Health Community Collaborative is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. David Kendrick, welcome back to the program. Tell us about the Route 66 Accountable Health Community. You're the principal investigator. What is that grant actually trying to do?
Well, this is a great program where Medicare, in particular, CMS, Centers for Medicaid, Medicare Services, have recognized that when we have our sickest patients in our communities that need medication and treatment and pretty complex management, they really can't get better if they're more focused on dealing with getting enough food to eat or transportation to see their doctor or to have enough roof over their head or the ability to pay their utility bills. They're just not going to be able to focus on getting better by getting their medications or exercising if they're worried more about their basic needs. And so in this program, Medicare has recognized that and placed some emphasis to the tune of $4.5 million per community on putting in place some screening programs so that when the patients come to see their doctor, not only do we ask how their blood pressure is doing and how they're feeling, but we ask about those important things like when's the last time you had healthy food to eat and do you have good access to fresh produce and do you have transportation to get to see me, things like that that while not obvious healthcare issues, they certainly contribute to each person's ability to get healthy.
So we have this increasing understanding that those barriers, as you mentioned, or those issues sort of prior to even getting to healthcare really make impact in individuals' health. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people go to the doctor's office now and you're going to start asking, first of all, who will ask these questions? Is it the doctors themselves or is it you're putting navigators into?
Well, so the way the program is set up, much like the other pieces of information are gathered in healthcare practices today, it'll be determined by those clinicians how they want to organize it within their own practices. The way we've suggested it be done is to think of these as vital signs because they certainly are. And, you know, the classically vital signs in healthcare are your blood pressure and your heart rate and your weight and your height and things like that. But whether you've got enough healthy food to eat and transportation, we think is also a vital sign and therefore could be gathered at the same time those other vital signs are being requested. And so, you know, we think of these other things as being in a category called social determinants of health, that is, social factors that contribute to your ability to get and stay healthy. And these social determinants have been studied, and there's a lot of literature on this, but it shows that generally speaking, while healthcare is the actual delivery of healthcare services is really only accountable for 10 to 20% of any individual's health and well-being, social determinants, those other factors, like we've been discussing, really account for most of around 70% of a person's ability to get healthy and stay healthy.
So walk us through it. So if you're now going to screen essentially in these practices, I mean, that's really the point of the grant and the intervention. I guess, I mean, I love the idea personally, but then how will patients who are in need be connected essentially?
Well, that's precisely the right question. You know, for years, those of us that work in healthcare have known how critical these questions are, but unfortunately, we just haven't had an answer to them when somebody screened positive. We didn't know exactly what to do with somebody who had a food shortage or transportation needs, there simply weren't resources or time or, frankly, skills and processes in most clinical settings to connect those patients in need with the right resources. And so the heart of this Accountable Health Communities program is that we make that connection possible. And so as a part of the program, most of the funding actually goes to cover navigators, which are individuals who are very experienced with and understand what resources exist in each community, like where are the food pantries, where are the housing agencies that can help people get a roof over their head or get into some housing situation that maybe begin temporary but become more permanent. And so those navigators, we'll have 7 of them in the Tulsa community and 7 of them in the Oklahoma City community, will become alerted when a patient in any of our participating healthcare organizations screens positive for one of these needs. And that navigator then, if the patient requests it, those navigators will reach out and say, okay, we understand you have this need. What can we do to help connect you to that service? What can we help do to help get you the services that you and your family need?
So how do you find these navigators and who are they? I mean, you mentioned they're skilled people who have this knowledge base. And I'm just trying to think through my head of, people that I know. There's definitely people who are kind of plugged into social services, but they may not know everything. I mean, so are these people with specialized degrees how do you find them?
That's a great question. It's really a kind of a new job description in most communities. And the navigator, I think first and foremost needs to have a real compassion and empathy for helping others. And that's really, to me, the primary requirement for the job. There's not really a specific degree requirement that's been established yet. We've partnered with the Oklahoma City County Health Department and the Tulsa Health Department to do this work, and so they will actually be hiring and deploying the navigators, and My Health Access Network, the group I'm a part of, will be providing the technology solution to support them. And so that's where we cover the gap between what they may or may not know about the services that are available and provide a resource directory for them so that they can actually find services, not just any food pantry or any transportation agency, but the one closest to where the patient lives, where the patient needs to get those services. And by sort of automating and providing those directory services, which we're doing in partnership with 211 in those two communities, we feel like a lot of folks will qualify to be navigators. And it really is going to come down to those who have a real passion and interest in helping individuals and families get the services they need.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. David Kendrick. He is the principal investigator of the Route 66 Accountable Health Community Collaborative. He's also the chief executive officer of the My Health Access Network. And in addition to that, he's the chairman of the Department of Medical Informatics at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. Quite a number of titles that you carry. But David Kendrick, so you mentioned, I don't want to gloss over that, 211. So I know some people in the listening audience are familiar with that, but 211, is that like 911 or 311? Remind us what that is.
Right. So 211 in the communities that are fortunate enough to have one is sort of a service that can connect individuals with the community resources on a broad range, ranging from the ones we've been talking about all the way to auto mechanics and other kinds of services in the community. And so by dialing 211, you're put in contact with a switchboard and a set of navigators of their own type, I suppose you'd say, to connect individuals with those services. Now, 211 traditionally focuses as I place the call, I get some advice about which services are available, and then I, as the individual, are responsible for following up on that myself and tracking down the service and accessing it. And there's really, in that situation, no understanding of whether the service was delivered or not, and no way to know if the loop got closed, so to speak. That is, that the recommendation for the service was given and that the family or individual availed themselves of that service, they accessed that service. One of the defining characteristics of this Route 66 program is that we have the ability to actually actively make the referral to a service with the individuals or family members directly a part of that referral, and then to know if they accessed that service so that the loop got closed so that we can do some important things with that information, like making sure we have enough of those services available. Are we short on food pantry services, and are we short on housing? Do we have enough transportation? So we can right-size the social service delivery system in our communities.
So that's a really interesting point, because I think about agencies that provide help in those domains. You mentioned housing, food security. I mean, other ones that are maybe harder are education, mm-hmm. employment, but certainly, you know, water as well. But let's just, I guess, stick with food and housing. And so we have agencies that exist to help folks with those. And, of course, they assess need based on how many people sort of show up.
Right.
And then, of course, they have various funding patterns or fundraisers and things like that. But we don't have – like, there's not a good – I'm asking your, I guess, computer scientist hat on now. I mean, there hasn't really been a good way to kind of survey the general population. But here you're actually going to get data from people who call in or who – identify these needs, and so you'll have, in a way, a more accurate account of what the community's need is in terms of overall and in aggregate these?
Well, and I guess I should say that the real target population for this program, since it is funded by Medicare, are the Medicare and Medicaid patients that live in our communities. And in particular, among those folks, it's the people who cross the threshold of a healthcare provider. So the screenings will occur in emergency rooms, in ambulatory care clinics, in labor and delivery units, community mental health centers, places where we know there's a health care need, but we can also suspect that there might be a social need as well. And that's to really sort of enrich the population so that we have a higher hit rate, so to speak, of folks who need the service. And so rather than calling everybody randomly in Tulsa, we make sure that we're focusing the delivery of this particular program to those most in need. Now, one of the potential downsides is by focusing only on Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries, that we could be missing a large swath of our community that really do have significant needs in this area, such as the uninsured, those who don't really appear on anybody's roster as having health insurance or access to those services. And I know we don't want to forget about those folks. We just need to find the funding mechanism to extend this program to them as well.
But so even in that uninsured population, which unfortunately in Oklahoma is larger than average because of we're one of the 19 or so states that has not expanded Medicaid to have a broader swath of the population. So I guess one thing I'm wondering too is you mentioned all those locations, emergency rooms, labor and delivery wards. You only have 7 navigators in each metropolitan area of Oklahoma, Tulsa and Oklahoma City. So where will they actually be? Are they the ones? They're not the ones answering the phone, and they're not necessarily the ones in the clinic. The clinics, the healthcare venues, as it were, they're going to be essentially trained or given technical assistance to make this a vital sign, as you say. So when, let's say there's a, you know, I'm seeing a Medicaid patient, and say the medical assistant or the nurse who's, you know, checking the blood pressure says, oh, you know, are you hungry or are you food secure? Or they ask that in a skilled way.
Right.
And they say, well, no, geez, I'm really having trouble, you know, getting food for me or my children. What's the next step? Or how does the navigator get involved or where?
Well, that's a great question. So first of all, let me say that this Route 66 consortium is sort of a governing body for the program. And so they're calling the team, the group of healthcare providers and social service agencies, are really reviewing and approving the workflows and the mechanisms that will go through. But I'll tell you how we propose that it happen, because the discussions are still ongoing about specific implementation. But the way we propose that it happen, which Medicare seems to like, is that when these patients cross the threshold for care and they are having their vital signs taken, one of the last questions that's asked, of course, is, you know, if any of these issues are true for you, would you like to be contacted with opportunities to access additional services? And when somebody that's considered an opt-in, and when the patient or family member opts into being contacted for that service, then those events, that piece of information is routed to electronically to those navigators who then get involved.
So you're essentially, as the data hub, you're generating a call list, as it were, for those navigators.
That's right.
And those could be huge call lists, but part of it seems like, as part of the process, you have to get buy-in from those venues, right? I mean,
that's right.
Okay.
I mean, people are actively participants in this. And, you know, from a mission perspective, it meets a lot of organizations, missions in both Oklahoma County and Tulsa County communities. I think that the one of the real opportunities here, and I should give you the numbers, the expectations of the funding agency, Medicare, is that we screen about 75,000 people a year.
That seems like a large number.
It does seem like a large number. And their estimate, which, you know, we'll see if it's true or not, is that about 4,000 of those people will need this more intensive level of services, of navigation services. And to hedge that bet a bit, what they've said is that really focus these services on folks who have more than one emergency room visit a year. Right, really tune the service so that you're really focusing on those who are using emergency room services, which is one of the more expensive ways to access healthcare on a more than one-time basis. And that way, you can know for sure that if you've invested, as you say, these navigation resources are somewhat precious and expensive. Once you've invested those services, they're really going to help out a family in need that's having to access much more expensive mechanisms of care otherwise. And I think that's a real differentiator. But what I also think is happening here is by calling these vital signs, we make it more a routine part of care. I know as providers, we're being encouraged more and more to ask these questions. But as I said a moment ago, it's been hard to ask those questions knowing that we didn't have a good answer if we got a yes, if we got a positive, if we didn't have anything really to offer these folks. But now that we begin to think about these as vital signs, I don't just do blood pressures on part of my patients. I do a blood pressure test on all my patients,
right?
Because I want to screen them for high blood pressure and get them the treatment if they need it. And this, I think the same should be true for these social needs. Patients with commercial insurance can have these needs as well. Patients, you know, who have jobs and busy lives can have a lot of these needs. I mean, among these needs are not just food and housing and public utility assistance, but also domestic violence and other things that really impact the quality of life for folks in our communities. And so by making this a routine part of the screening, our hope is that not just Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries will get screened, but that in general, everybody who walks through the door will get screened for these things.
That's a really good point. One thing I wonder, too, is you mentioned at the outset that it doesn't sound like a top-down approach. That is, you're not saying which category of person, whether it's a doctor, a nurse, a medical assistant, or, I mean, a community health worker for that matter, somebody who may have very little medical experience, but you said who's compassionate and really cares about people and has some working knowledge of many of the social service agencies and, I guess you could even say, systems in our cities. You mentioned that CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they are hoping you'll screen 75,000 patients a year for, is it 4 years of the grant?
It's a five-year program.
Five-year program. Mm-hmm. And the estimate, I don't know if you came up with that or they did, but that maybe 4,000 people will have these needs. I guess my one question is, what happens if it's vastly higher, if it's you know, 20 or 30,000 people that have these needs and you're just totally swamped?
I think it's a great problem to have because that need exists whether we ask the question or not. And if we identify that much additional need, I'm convinced both participating communities, Oklahoma County and Tulsa County, have the philanthropies and the providers that will step up to the plate and make sure those needs get met. I think the problem that we often have in both the philanthropic community and from state agencies and local governments is not really being able to quantify the need accurately. And if we do identify a lot more need, then we'll roll up our sleeves and figure out how we can get it met.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. David Kendrick. He's principal investigator on the Route 66 Accountable Health Community Collaborative, also the CEO of the My Health Access Network, which is a health information exchange linking a multitude of practices in Oklahoma, really in some ways beyond, in terms of health information on patients. And then he also happens to be the chairman of the Department of Medical Informatics at the OUTU School of Community Medicine. So Route 66 Accountable Health Community, can you unpack where that name comes from? Route 66 seems kind of obvious. It's, you know, we're connecting Tulsa and Oklahoma City, but you said there's kind of a story there. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, sure. So the Accountable Health Community's name first is what Medicare calls this program, and it's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation that actually sponsors it. And, you know, that name sort of is self-explanatory. This is a community-level effort where real change can happen, and we're focusing on health, but all aspects of health. And it's sort of, we're taking on some accountability to help that health become reality for folks, especially everybody who participates in the program. Now, in terms of the Route 66 label that we put on it, the rules for the program said you could have one from each state, and each state Medicaid agency could support one program. And both Oklahoma County and Tulsa County stepped up early on and said, we want to do this. We want to do this project. Lots of stakeholders, literally hundreds of different organizations involved in this effort. And it just never was a way to pick one or the other when you had so much effort. So we came together and proposed, when MyHealth got into the mix, we proposed that let's make this something that ties us all together. And that would be the Mother Road, probably the first example of a major information and commerce interchange there, linking the two communities. And let's make this the Route 66 project.
I mean, that's actually really a big deal. Right, I mean, to get that kind of collaboration between Tulsa and Oklahoma City, that doesn't often happen, or I mean, anecdotally, we don't think it happens that often. But that's a congratulations, because that's really something to behold.
Yeah, I have to say, it's really a fantastic occurrence. I think people think the turnpike between the two cities, the two communities, must be 1,000 miles long. It's really not. But this is an effort to really have both communities put their money where their mouth is. And I sort of teased in one of our kickoff meetings the other day that, you know, maybe the mayors would like to sign up for a little healthy competition around this and try and get, have the most successful component of the program.
So, and you mentioned too, you know, I think hundreds, and I think in the press release it said something like 500 service agencies have been identified, I guess, to participate or to kind of sign up. Explain how that works or how they lined up, and then they just make themselves available in the sort of the Rolodex of services?
That's right. So, the really four components of this program are the healthcare delivery system, the hospitals and clinics where folks seek care, and they enter into the system through that by being screened. And then there's the payer side of it, which would be Medicare and Medicaid in this case, who actually fund the program. And then there's the navigation service we talked about, which is that, you know, helping those connect families and individuals to the right services. And then the social services component of it is literally, I was shocked when we started to really catalog the kinds of agencies that were in our communities. And when we say 500, we're only referring to those agencies that support food needs, housing, transportation, public utilities, and interpersonal or domestic violence support. And think of all the other social services that we have in our communities beyond that, for early childhood programs, lots of other things. So we really do have quite a number of service agencies out there that are there to help. But the real sort of devil in the details, or the challenge, is integrating them into the normal flow of care and of the conversation with the healthcare delivery systems. And that's what this effort is to do.
Okay, so as with any grant or really scientific study, because that's essentially what this is, how will you know if you've achieved success? And I think short term it's going to be if you actually hit the target numbers of 75,000 a year. But I guess bigger picture, how will you know if you've achieved success?
Well, I think what we'll start to see is that we're making meaningful able to make meaningful decisions based on data about which social services we need more of or less of, where they need to be positioned. And then over time, of course, it'll be real indicators that health is improving and quality of life is improving in our communities, that ultimately we have less need for access to, you know, to food, additional food, or less need for access to transportation, because we've come up eventually with systemic solutions, you know, better public transportation or, better access to food services across, through the school systems, for example. So I think that the longer term outcomes of this is really a healthier, happier population.
And so, that begs a question, I guess, of what, if you are successful in terms of figuring out the need. And you could, I guess you could imagine in a way that there might be an agency or two or even, you know, half a dozen where if the need for what they're kind of out raising money for and developing, they may find that their mission is somewhat curtailed. I mean, many social service agencies would say, hey, we'd be glad to go out of business because we like the social problem we're addressing has gone away. But nevertheless, you know, people have jobs and I mean, there's egos at stake and dollars at stake. So, I mean, that I guess that could potentially be a thorny type of issue.
You know, having worked with organizations like this for a while and being part of a nonprofit myself in my health, I think if what we're focused on is curing a disease or preventing a bad experience for a child or for adults, we'd be glad for that need to go away. I think, you know, let's just take, for example, polio. How many polio organizations are out there actively raising money right now since the institution of the vaccine? I mean, those organizations were probably happy to shift their focus to Alzheimer's disease or to some other element of need. And I have a lot of sort of faith in the human character that is able to say, okay, we've solved a problem now, or we've lessened the burden of a particular problem. Let's shift to the next most important thing. So I don't really think that's going to be a concern. Certainly not in the short term for this. We've got plenty of need.
What's the time frame for the Route 66? Like, when does this roll out?
So we hope to be in pilot early in next year, and early in 2018. And by May 1st of 2018, we'll be in full active mode.
So both the Tulsa and Oklahoma City health departments will have the navigators like up and hired. I mean, are they like hiring right now?
Pretty close. Uh-huh. They'll be posting in the next month or two.
Okay. So, I mean, if listeners are interested, they could even look on those websites.
That's right. That's right. And I should say, if I can just make a plug for a moment, this kind of project is a community project, and it's really driven by sweat equity, meaning those who put the effort into it will get the results they want. And so the governance for this project, which we're supporting from my health's perspective, really depends on people showing up and giving the best of their time and of their interest to this effort. So anyone who's interested in participating in the program and in helping to guide where it needs to go, if you have a particular passion for one of these social needs, get involved. Contact us at MyHealth. Our website's www.myhealthaccess.net. And let us know. Click the information button and let us know that you'd like to participate, because it is, again, an open community project and relies on everybody's elbow grease.
Dr. David Kendrick is principal investigator of the Route 66 Accountable Health Community Collaborative, and he's also the CEO of My Health Access Network. Dr. David Kendrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.